We beat the teachers union. We've even done paycheck protection so that school unions, so the teachers aren't forced to do dues, and now they're choosing other things.
Thousands of workers in Florida are losing their labor unions thanks to a new law passed last year by Republicans.
So every provision in our collective bargaining agreement is really critical.
As union members across the state have been decertified and more are at risk.
That doesn't sound good, does it, Florida?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
Not in Florida.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Hey there. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., now sunny L.A. today for a happy change. Also in Red Bluff and Redding, California on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, Seattle's KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day for your listening convenience on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com, now celebrating 20 years of troublemaking and muckraking. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of The Bradcast. Yesterday on the program, we had what could turn out to be some very good news specifically for organized labor up in the great state of Wisconsin after, so far, 13 years of trying to sort of dig out from under the anti-worker, anti-labor policies of former Governor Scott Walker and state Republicans who gerrymandered themselves into power for more than a decade. Now, today I want to spend a bit more time on what our guest John Nichols reported as now happening across the pond, as no one says, in Michigan. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
Where that state has clawed its way back from gerrymandered Republican authoritarianism a few years ago, and especially since the 2022 elections, they are finally beginning to enjoy the fruits of those efforts in Michigan, including the first time in decades that an anti-labor, so-called right-to-work law in this country has actually been overturned. And it happened just last week. So, but with the good news in Wisconsin and in Michigan, unfortunately, we need to counter it with the nightmares, frankly, that are now underway for organized labor in Ron DeSantis's Florida, as hundreds of labor unions now face literally being wiped out of existence by the heavy hand of state regulations that specifically target public sector workers, teachers, as you heard at the top of the show, engineers, 911 center call answerers. We'll be joined by the legislative and political director of the Florida AFL-CIO shortly from the Capitol building in Tallahassee, where an effort is underway even at this hour to try and force some pro-worker amendments into a bill that could come to the floor today that attempts to fix at least some of the damage that was caused by the GOP anti-labor bill that was adopted last year on behalf of then presidential candidate Ron DeSantis in the Sunshine State. That Senate bill known as SB 256, the one that was passed last year. But with that, that perhaps grim news, I guess, ahead today, at least in the DeSantis Republic of Florida. Let me see if we can find a little bit more encouraging news, at least to kick things off today.
Although I will say that from what it sounds like in Florida, it is grim news, but they are fighting.
Well, some are fighting. The AFL-CIO is fighting.
Yes.
It remains to be seen how many of the workers are fighting, how many of the voters are fighting, how much of, you know, the anger about what is actually going on now that it's actually going on in Florida is actually going to translate itself into votes this November. We will see. We'll talk to our guest about that momentarily. But as I said, Desi, I was trying to bring a little, you know, encouraging, some levity, something to enjoy today before we get to the grim state of Florida. So here's a story, and I don't know about you, but I'll tell you, I enjoyed a rush of endorphins. Is that what it is when you feel good about something, when something makes you feel happy?
Yes.
Okay. I had some of those happen when I heard about this story late last night, so I will take them wherever I can find them these days. Just days after a New York State Superior Court judge ordered former President Donald Trump to pay some $355 million in the massive civil fraud case filed against him, his company, and his company's top executives, including his two eldest sons, who, along with Trump, have been banned from doing business in the state for the next 2 years. In Eric and Don Jr.'s case, it's 2 years. In Donald's case, it's three. So just days after that ruling, New York Attorney General Letitia James, the one who brung it, told ABC News that she is prepared to seize the former president's assets if he is unable to find the cash to cover the gargantuan fine. Allow those endorphins now to just flow through you. Trump was fined $354.8 million. That's a lot of money. Plus, but that was the number that everyone was reporting. In fact, there is it also includes approximately $100 million in what is known as pre-judgment interest. This was the fine announced on Friday by New York Superior Court Judge Arthur Engoron after he determined that the inflated net worth of Donald Trump was fraudulent. That inflated net worth of his assets was to get more favorable loan terms from banks to the tune of anywhere from $2 billion to $3.6 billion per year. That's how much he was inflating the worth of his own assets. $2 billion to $3.6 billion per year over the 11 years before the lawsuit was filed in 2022. It only goes back 11 years because that's the statute of limitations on this. This dude was no doubt doing this for decades prior to that as well. But when it comes to that $100 million in prejudgment interest, so in addition to that, let's call it $355 million, the ruling also imposes 9% per annum interest. In other words, 9% annual interest on penalties that is backdated as early as 2019. As a result, the total amount that's actually owed by Trump is now approximately $454 million.
Mm, wow. That's a lot.
And counting, by the way, because the interest continues to accrue every single day until the fine is actually paid off. Currently, it's accruing at something like $87,000 per day. Every day that he does not pay that fine costs him some $87,000. Given that, Trump does not have a fixed deadline that he must make the payment. I was trying to figure out, well, when does he have to pay this money by? In truth, he can wait really as long as he wants to some extent, but the longer that he delays, the more interest accumulates in what he owes, potentially pushing the total much higher than it even is now, which is at about $454 million. And that, of course, is no small burden given his ever mounting legal debts that he's accruing in all of his other ongoing legal cases, including 4 criminal cases. In summary, his obligation to pay the New York fine along with interest remains open-ended, and the final amount could actually end up being much, much higher the longer that he waits. Now, Trump has, of course, denied all wrongdoing. He said he will appeal, but that appeal, as I understand it, must be filed 30 days from the date that the verdict was issued last Friday. So that's something like mid-March. And he'll have to either put all the money down by then in order to make that appeal, plus interest in cash in order to file the appeal, or he'll have to post a bond if he can find someone willing to do so on his behalf to loan him money, which won't be easy because part of the penalty is that he's also not allowed to work with any banks for 3 years that are registered to do business in the state of New York, which is pretty much all of the banks. So Attorney General Tish James, her remarks on Tuesday, therefore, were notable, at least to me, as she told ABC News, quote, "If he does not have funds to pay off the judgment, then we will seek judgment enforcement mechanisms in court and we will ask the judge to seize his assets." In other words, to take his buildings from him, if necessary, to cover what he owes the state. So that could be fun.
Yes, that would be a big thing.
Saying that she was, quote, "very confident with the strength of her case on appeal." Tish James reiterated that her office would not hesitate to seize Trump's assets. And she mentioned Trump's 40 Wall Street skyscraper specifically by name if the former president is unable to find the cash to cover the court-ordered disgorgement. Quote, "We are prepared to make sure that the judgment is paid to New Yorkers. And yes, I look at 40 Wall Street each and every day," she said. She was sort of speaking of the standard court process, according to ABC, for collecting judgments in civil cases. When someone owes money and they're not able to pay it, well, the prosecutors look at their assets and see what can be taken from them to cover those fines. Tish James also directly countered Trump's allegations that the case lacked any victims, which we discussed a little bit on yesterday's show, instead describing her case as vital to ensuring financial markets treat all New Yorkers fairly. Quote, "Financial frauds are not victimless crimes. He engaged in a massive amount of fraud. It wasn't just a simple mistake, a slight oversight. The variations," she said, on his statement of financial condition, listing the worth of his assets, "are wildly exaggerated," she said, "and the extent of the fraud was staggering. If average New Yorkers went into a bank and submitted false documents, the government would throw the book at them," she said, "and the same should be true for former presidents." Oh, you go, girl. And now she has. She has thrown the book at her. I don't think she's kidding about this. Now, you know, I think that this guy is actually a very good actor. Bad actor, but a good bad actor. and he knows, you know, not to let anyone notice. But boy, you know, this dude is in a world of hurt right now. Do not be mistaken. I mean, in this case, even if he were to win the presidency, it's a state case. So it cannot be wiped out by, you know, a pardon or something. And by the way, civil cases entirely cannot be wiped out by pardon, no matter what, even, you know, at the federal level. And there are a few civil cases at the federal level concerning January 6th and what he did there that we have not even begun to discuss on this program. So don't be fooled and just, you know, grab your popcorn because that part of this is all going to be fun. In the meantime, what's the guy who Donald Trump will presumably be running against this fall doing? Well, he's helping to pay off the student loans for hundreds of thousands of Americans. Yes, while Donald Trump is figuring out what new scams he can put together, what new crappy tennis shoes or smelly cologne he can sell in order to try to pay off his enormous fines in that civil penalty alone, that doesn't even touch the rape charges against him in E. Jean Carroll's case. That's up to about 80. That starts at about $80 million. So what's the other guy doing? What's Joe Biden doing? He's helping people get out of debt. The Biden administration on Wednesday said that it is automatically forgiving $1.2 billion in student debt for 153,000 borrowers. Loan holders whose debt will be discharged will receive an email from President Joe Biden today, personally.
Check your email.
Yep. Informing them of the forgiveness, according to the Department of Education. I suspect a lot of people were very happy opening their email today. The debt relief is the latest push from the White House to address the nation's $1.77 trillion in student debt after the Supreme Court last year invalidated the Biden administration's plan for a broad-based student loan forgiveness that would have forgiven loans for millions of Americans, tens of millions. That plan would have helped more than 40 million borrowers each wipe away up to $20,000 in debt. It was done under a law. What Joe Biden had attempted to do was done under the same law that Donald Trump had used to change the terms of student loans when he was in office. But of course, the corrupted, packed, far right, not at all actually conservative Supreme Court majority blocked President Biden from using the very same law. Nonetheless, with this latest round of debt forgiveness, the Biden administration says it has now approved loan relief for nearly 3.9 million borrowers, many of whom have been repaying their debt now for decades. The 153,000 borrowers who qualify anew for the latest debt forgiveness are those who are enrolled in the Saving on a Valuable Education Repayment Plan. That's the SAVE plan. Folks who are on the SAVE plan who have made at least 10 years of payments now. U.S. Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona said in the statement, if you've been paying for a decade, you've done your part and you deserve relief. Cardona sounds Mexican-y. Impeach. Impeach. What do borrowers have to do to get this repayment? They have to do nothing. They will receive a loan discharge. News about that in an email from Biden today, and they don't need to take any further action. The SAVE plan, by the way, is an income-driven repayment program. It was created by the Biden administration. It's their monthly payments are pegged to their income. It lowers their financial burden based on how much they actually make. The SAVE plan was designed to fix some problems with similar older programs by other administrations, which would allow interest to snowball on a borrower's debt. So there's some good news.
Yeah, that's very good news.
Yeah, I thought so. There are currently 7.5 million borrowers enrolled in that program. About 4.3 of those have, by the way, zero monthly payments based on their income. And many of them now will have their debts wiped out entirely so they can move on to putting that money into the economy instead, which you would think Republicans would be in favor of. But, well, you know, they don't actually mean anything that they say at this point. Anything. Especially when they say stuff like, oh, we're the party of the working people. That's hilarious. We oppose big government regulation. That's hilarious. Because as reality would have it, Republicans have been for decades putting their boot on the neck of working people with, yes, big government regulations, at least when it comes to those workers' rights to organize and collective bargain against their employers. And though it's taken some time, decades, in fact, in states like Michigan and at least a decade so far in the great state of Wisconsin, the working folks are finally pushing back in the courts, and most importantly, at the ballot box, and they are clawing back their rights. but not everywhere. Not in Emperor Ron DeSantis's Florida, at least not yet. But you know, once workers begin to feel the effects of his and state Republicans' massive new anti-labor law, things may turn around quite quickly in the Sunshine State as well. All of that is next on the broadcast as we're joined by Florida's AFL-CIO legislative and political director Rich Templin, live from the Capitol Building in Tallahassee. I'm Brad Friedman, and you're listening to the broadcast.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the broadcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Join a union, fight for better pay. You better join a union, brother.
Offer may not soon be available in the state of Florida. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from BradBlog.com. Yesterday, we spoke with our friend John Nichols of The Nation about the great news coming out of Wisconsin this week. Democrats and grassroots progressives in the great state of Wisconsin, after 13 long years, finally appear to have brought an end to the outrageous Republican gerrymanders in both the state assembly and Senate out there, which state Republicans had used for all measure of power grabs, including the law that kicked it all off more than a decade ago, when, armed with the knowledge that their gerrymanders would keep them in power no matter how the voting populace felt about it, they gutted the ability for public unions to collectively bargain. Well, public unions other than the right-leaning police and firefighters unions, in any case. Depending on how this November election goes in the Badger State, the longtime Wisconsin native Nichols, John Nichols, told me, you could see if Democrats are actually able to gain control of both chambers of the state legislature on the fairer maps that will finally be used this year, one of the first things that could happen would be a repeal of the much-despised Act 10 that essentially gutted the ability for collective bargaining for state workers in the very home of the public sector union movement. In our conversation yesterday, John cited Michigan, however, as the state setting the example right now for what folks in neighboring Wisconsin may be able to look forward to if they continue to organize and to vote.
Look to Michigan, because Wisconsin is still in process, right? Yeah. Wisconsin is still struggling to get there. Mm-hmm. Michigan got there. Mm. They got independent redistricting, mm-hmm. which drew fair maps, mm-hmm. after the 2018 election. In 2022, they had fair maps, finally, after a long process. They elected a Democratic state assembly. They elected a Democratic state senate. And I was in Michigan last Tuesday as the laws officially went on the books, eliminating their anti-labor right to work law,
yep.
expanding collective bargaining rights,
yep.
for teachers and for graduate students. Restoring all sorts of wage protections for construction workers. Michigan has now gone from a year ago, just a couple years ago, being one of the more anti-labor states in the northern part of the country, to having probably the best labor laws, or very close to the best labor laws in the country. That's what you get when you don't give up. You get to actually transform it.
In fact, as Nichols reported at The Nation last week, quote, for the first time in almost 60 years, a state has formally overturned a so-called right-to-work law, clearing the way for workers to organize new union locals, collectively bargain, and make their voices heard at election time this year in Michigan. Just last week, Michigan finalized the process of eliminating a decade-old so-called right-to-work law, which began with the shift in control of the state legislature from anti-union Republicans to pro-union Democrats following the 2022 election. Said Michigan AFL-CIO President Ron Biber, quote, "This moment has been decades in the making. By standing up and taking their power back at the ballot box and in the workplace, workers have made it clear Michigan is and always will be the beating heart of the modern American labor movement." In addition to formally scrapping the anti-labor law last week, Michigan also restored prevailing wage protections for construction workers, expanded collective bargaining rights for public school employees, restored organizing rights for graduate student research assistants at the state's public college and universities. The Teamsters Union celebrated the win in Michigan with social media postings, including party hats and confetti. The Service Employees International Union, or SEIU, celebrated the news as a, quote, "big win," tweeting, "After a decade of organizing and voting for change, Michigan workers just officially won the repeal of the state's so-called right-to-work law. This," he said, "is the power we have when we unite at work, in the streets, and at the ballot box." "The tide has begun to turn," Nichols reported, "beginning in a state with a rich labor history, and that's got the attention of union activists and working-class people nationwide." Well, it certainly has the attention of working folks in Wisconsin who want to see a decade of GOP gerrymandered anti-labor laws turned back in their state, now that at long last candidates for office will be able to compete on an at least nearly level playing field again in the Badger State. But of course, all of that good news up north, I know, unusual to have that much encouraging news all at once on this program. Well, don't worry. Unfortunately, we will balance that off today by what is going on in Ron DeSantis's increasingly authoritarian and anti-worker state of Florida. As Daniel Rivero writes in a lengthy and often jaw-dropping investigative report at South Florida's public radio outlet, WLRN, in St. Johns County, on the Atlantic shore of Northeast Florida, more than 55% of public school teachers paid their union dues this last year. Despite that, nearly 3,500 teachers are now facing the threat of having their union representation entirely revoked by order of the state. At the same time, in Southwest Florida, only 16% of law enforcement officers of the Charlotte County Sheriff's Office paid their union dues last year, but their union is under absolutely no threat of being decertified. A year after Governor DeSantis signed into law a sweeping anti-union bill requiring most public sector unions to boost the rate of members paying dues or face being officially disbanded by the state, the full effects of the new union rules are coming into clear view. Law enforcement, firefighter, and correctional officer unions are exempt from the new law, no matter how few members pay union dues. But for other public sector unions, what is emerging is an outright crisis. A labor economist warned that the law could prove to be more effective in destroying labor power in Florida than the landmark Act 10 proved to be up in Wisconsin, a law broadly considered as one of the strongest anti-union laws ever passed by a state government. After reviewing hundreds of pages of state union recertification filings, WLRN can reveal that already several tens of thousands of workers have quietly lost their collective bargaining rights in Florida, a right that Rivero notes is explicitly protected by the Florida Constitution. Unions representing tens of thousands of additional public sector workers across the state are now in danger of being decertified and dissolved. Most affected employees perform core public sector jobs like teaching in schools, doing clerical work for state and local government,
repairing engines and machinery for government agencies, answering 911 calls at call centers, and working at city parks. Public sector unions help negotiate everything from break times to purchasing new equipment to setting standards for general working conditions and safety, and laying out a process for discipline or termination of employees. Without a union to negotiate or enforce a collective bargaining agreement, those negotiated worker protections can now be reversed. Some advocates fear that as collective bargaining agreements are threatened or outright killed, it will impact how many people choose to work in the public sector, something that can directly impact public services for millions of Floridians. Dozens of the at-risk unions have existed in Florida for decades now, stretching back a full 50 years when the Florida Public Relations Act required the state and local governments to negotiate with unions in good faith. The full scope of this new law, called Senate Bill 256, is still coming into focus, reports WLRN, but it is abundantly clear that it will have a major impact on labor in Florida for the foreseeable future. Quote, "The work conditions of hundreds of thousands of people are going to be up in the air," said Rich Templin, the director of politics and public policy for the AFL-CIO in Florida, the largest labor organization in the state, representing 500 local unions across it. Quote, "That's real lives. That's not politics," said Templin. "That's not pro-union, anti-union. It's none of that. People's lives are going to be upended." And yet, all of this receiving very little coverage in the national media compared to, well, 10 years or so ago in Wisconsin. Joining us now from, I think, somewhere in the Florida State Legislature today in Tallahassee, where a bill to perhaps fix some of SB 256's most egregious anti-worker policies. Such a bill, a fixed bill, may make it to the floor at any time over the next few hours at the Capitol. From that Capitol is Rich Templin of Florida's AFL-CIO to explain this remarkable series of events in Ron DeSantis's anti-worker Florida, which has, at least up until now, largely flown below the national media radar. Mr. Templin, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
All right. How are you, sir?
I am okay. I am troubled. I got to say, I was gobsmacked by WLRN's investigative report on just how many local unions and people across the state of Florida are now at risk of being decertified entirely this year by the state, despite, you know, supposed protections in the state constitution and theoretically at the federal level. Before I get to some of my more specific questions, Rich, explain, if you could, in simple terms, if possible, what Florida's SB 256 does and what the threat is that it now poses to workers and unions beginning now, this year.
Well, and thanks. It is a sordid, complicated tale. So in the state of Florida, back in 1968, when we had a constitutional convention, the state adopted Article 1, Section 6 of Florida's Constitution. And the interesting thing, you know, is Article 1, like most constitutions, is where we have the right to freedom of religion, the right of, you know, freedom of speech. In Florida, the right to own a firearm. Mm-hmm. And so right smack dab in the middle of all these rights that people take for granted is the right to collectively bargain for public sector workers. Mm. In the same section, however, is the right to work, meaning that no individual can be denied the right to collectively bargain by refusing to pay dues. Nobody can be compelled to be a dues-paying member of a labor union, even though that labor union is negotiating their contract. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, the right to freeload, right? Mm-hmm. To get something for free.
Yep.
Obviously, that's something in America that folks, you know, everybody likes free stuff. So what we've seen over the years is that while dues paying union membership may be at, you know, 30%, 40%, when there's a new contract negotiation and the contract comes out, mm-hmm. all employees are able to vote on the contract, not just the dues-paying member. Mm-hmm. And then we typically see 90% of the workplace come out and vote, you know, usually in favor of the contract. Mm-hmm. So it's always been apparent that folks enjoy the ability to be represented by a collective bargaining agent. They enjoy the ability not to have to pay dues to support that. And they enjoy the benefits that come at the end of a negotiation. And so because of that right to work, the number of dues paying union members has always been kind of, you know, artificially deflated. Mm-hmm. So what Senate Bill 256 did, and it did a lot, but just the high notes. Mm-hmm. In Florida, most union members had their dues voluntarily mm-hmm. deducted from their paychecks.
Right.
They never thought about it.
Right.
And in Florida, we have hundreds of authorized paycheck deductions. Employees at universities can have money deducted from their check for football tickets, deductions for parking, deductions to support the United Way. I mean, they're all over the place. Well, Senate Bill 256 eliminated the paycheck deduction only for union dues. So they singled out one deduction out of hundreds,
right,
and made that illegal. However, they did not make that paycheck deduction illegal for police officers and firefighters.
Huh.
They were exempt from the law. The second thing the bill did was require that 60% of a bargaining unit must be members of the union for that union to continue to survive, for them to be recertified at the end of the, you know, at the proper period.
Uh-huh.
So they take away the ability for members to conveniently pay their dues. And then they say, if there's not enough of you paying dues, you lose your union altogether.
And that again, that number is 60% is what it needs to be in order to remain certified, or they decertify them. And essentially what? The union goes away. It has no right to negotiate on behalf of those workers.
Well, we're not certain yet. This has been a time of great chaos. The bill itself, and those were just two of the provisions. There's a whole bunch of other bureaucratic hurdles that have been established to make it impossible for public sector unions to exist. Now, you know, they did it. They did this, you know, death by a thousand paper cuts, because the Constitution doesn't allow them to do what they did in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, once they made all these changes, when the bill was going through the process, we pointed out to lawmakers over and over and over again, and there were hundreds of union workers in Tallahassee. We packed every meeting. We packed the hearing chambers. We were there when the bills were passing their respective chambers, the House and Senate. But what we told them was that this stuff is unworkable. And the reason it was unworkable, and the reason the bill was written so badly, mm-hmm. that it was written by an out-of-state billionaire-funded think tank called mm-hmm. the Freedom Foundation, mm-hmm. who have bragged publicly and on their website and in a book. They even wrote a book about how they screwed over working people in Florida. Yeah. I mean, I don't understand anybody that wakes up happy for their job if that's their job, is to go from state to state and screw people they've never met before. Yeah. But okay. And so the bill was so badly worded because this Freedom Foundation didn't understand state law. They just didn't know. And the lawmakers were literally just passing what they were handed.
Well, Rich, you know, are you sure they didn't know? Because it seems like it was pretty effective. When this, I think it was October, the part of this law went into effect that says, you know, if you don't have 60% dues-paying members, that the union can be decertified. It looks like it's going to be very successful in wiping out unions up and down the state of Florida.
Well, when I say they didn't know, it's the death by a thousand paper cuts. That's what we were trying to show them was unworkable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once the bill passed, the lack of paycheck deduction, okay. The 60% threshold requirement, okay. But it was all of these other little pieces.
Mm.
So when the agency charged with implementing and writing the rules for this law, began the rulemaking process, it became very evident that they couldn't do it.
Mm.
And so month after month, hearing after hearing, workshop after workshop, they kept issuing rules and then retracting those rules and then issuing new ones. And then to add a little flavor to this, the Freedom Foundation became intimately involved behind the scenes, and we have journalists in Florida that have gotten this information through public records requests.
Mm-hmm.
The Freedom Foundation basically became another member of the Public Employee Relations Commission. And so they were constantly feeding them ideas and information to make it more impossible for us to comply with the law. That's what's happening right now, is we're not able to comply.
I was struck, Rich, and all of this kind of reminded me of the amendment that the state passed overwhelmingly to allow former felons to vote again in the state of Florida. And then the GOP-controlled state legislature quickly passed a law that said, well, they can only vote under that constitutional right if they paid off all of their fines and fees. But there was no database for anybody to figure out, you know, who owed what for fines and fees. And the people who were newly enfranchised voters didn't know if they were going to be breaking the law by casting a vote. Seems something similar here. Appears to be no official database available of, you know, the status of the various unions and the union members. Am I right that really
Correct.
This is happening and no one knows how bad it is or isn't?
Yes, and it's very similar to that. That's a really good comparison. So, but as the rulemaking was going on, we realized that there would have to be what's called a glitch bill.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny thing is the police and fire unions got wrapped up in it too, based on the poor wording of the law. So the police and fire unions, which have a lot of Republican clout here in Florida, they were you know, petitioning the legislature to do a glitch bill. And we've been working through that process and with limited success, but we're continually trying to refine how the interpretation is, you know, making clarifications so that we can comply with the law.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the interesting thing is really how we got here. Now, understand, this legislation or something like it has been filed 9 times in the last, I think, 15 years mm-hmm. here in the state of Florida.
Right.
And the legislation has failed each and every time because that what you often see, Republican animosity towards unions, has never been. It's never been that pronounced here in the state of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
You know, during elections, we have unions that endorse Republicans. We have unions that we have Republican lawmakers who have helped organize labor over the years because they realize that organized labor can help them solve a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm.
That changed when Ron DeSantis decided to run for president. The last 3 sessions that we've had here in Florida, mm-hmm. not so much including this one, were characterized by 3 things. The entire legislative process was hijacked. The governor was the emperor. He had complete deference from the Speaker of the House, the President of the Senate, and anybody in either Republican caucus.
Mm-hmm.
And he used that power to do 3 things. Number one, fight these culture wars that generate headlines for him in his then yet declared bid for the Republican nomination for President of the United States. That's why you've seen so many ridiculous headlines coming out of Florida. Yep. Book bans, don't say gay, right. All of that.
Yep.
The second thing was he was rewarding his biggest donors, not only past donors, but future donors that he could count on for the campaign. The third thing, and this is where we fall into this category, catering favor with national organizations that can provide national endorsements and national money. Mm-hmm. And that's how we got sucked up into it. Mm. Because the extensive Koch Brothers network,
yep.
You know, that includes Americans for Prosperity, the Freedom Foundation, you know, all right. of these different think tanks that we talk about so much. He did this for them. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, this bill, of all of the major things that the governor did and all of the different ways that he has really destroyed the state of Florida. I mean, we are in shambles. It is going to take us a decade to dig out from what he's done. Mm. And our issue, the union bill, Senate Bill 256, had the most Republican defections in the House and Senate. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, there was not a single Republican in the Senate who spoke in favor of the legislation except the bill sponsor. Out of 120 members of the Florida House, only three spoke in support of it.
And yet it got through. Yet it got through, Rich. How'd that happen?
It got through because they held their nose and they voted for it.
Now, I know that the Florida's Democratic Party has sort of been suffering, you know, a long and painful death for many years in recent
years.
That's
generous.
Well, I'm trying to be generous. But was there a clear partisan divide, at least, in the passage of SB 256? Or was it one of those bills that, you know, some so-called moderate Democrats were sort of daft enough to fall for out there?
Yeah, no, there wasn't a single Democratic vote for that issue. And again, there was a sizable number of Republican votes against it. So, you know, what we're seeing now, and when you look at the data and you know, I worked with him on his story, mm-hmm. but what you're seeing reflected in that data, I don't know how predictive it is about the future of organized labor in the public sector here in Florida, because so much of these like immediate decertifications mm-hmm. are a result of the botched process. They're a result of poor rules. Now, in some cases, there were national unions, national affiliates that had locals in the state. They looked at those locals. I mean, they had to do triage, right? They look at those locals and they say, this local union has, you know, 6% dues paying members, the entire bargaining unit. Mm-hmm. There's nothing we can do to save that in the tiny amount of time that they gave us to do so. So they were kind of allowed to be decertified.
Right.
In other cases, those decertification right now are showing, you know, the need for an election, because the process in Florida still allows for another union election if a bargaining agent is decertified.
Well, let me jump in there for a second, Rich, because politics aside, as far as how this came about, as far as the fix bill that I know you're trying to help get through or add some amendments to take care of some of this, this has a very real effect on what appears to be thousands of people. When we talk about decertifying these unions under this law, well, they're decertified, but then they have to go through to become recertified. They have to sort of start the whole process all over again, have another union election. What happens to, you know, existing negotiated contracts in the meantime after decertification like that?
That that was the other issue I was going to bring up. Article 1 of Florida's Constitution also guarantees that a law cannot be passed, the legislature can take no action that voids a current legally binding contract, mm-hmm. of which these collective bargaining agreements are. So what will happen to those contracts without anybody there to service them is still unknown. There are numerous cases being contemplated or already on dockets in Florida courts to try to determine that. So we're just not sure.
How could there not be a stay on this law with so many uncertainties? I assume that there have been I know there has been a legal action filed here. How could there not be a stay on some of this stuff until it's sorted out?
The judicial environment in Florida right now for anything against the governor is not a good one. The governor has done a very good job of remaking the courts in his image.
What about the federal level? Does the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, or the Department of Labor, do they have any say in this? Is there any legal options at the federal level to block it?
No, because the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Act, only apply to the private sector. So in these public sector unions, it's left up to the states. Now, there are, of course, federal issues. We've got cases pending on compelled speech for this mandated form that they're mm-hmm. making us use. Mm. And so there are federal issues, but largely the state issues will be decided in state court. The clearest case of all is Article 1, Section 6, that says you have the right to collectively bargain and you have the right not to pay for it.
Right.
Well, this is the first time in state history where the state law says your membership is determined by the paying of dues. And if you don't have enough members, you can't collectively bargain. Well, what the hell?
Yeah,
that's a mandated charge to be able to collectively bargain, which is a violation of that entire section of the Constitution.
It sure as hell seems like it. Rich Templin, I've got just a minute or two here. We have been reporting for some time on this program about what appears to be a resurgence in support for the union movement, you know, nationally in recent years, both public and private sector, really across the nation. What Florida is doing here, however, would seem to be in opposition to that movement, to what we're seeing going on in Wisconsin and Michigan and so forth. How is it playing politically in the state now that SB 256 is sort of becoming a reality and beginning to shut down these unions? I mean, it just seems like bad, stupid, dumb politics, no matter how much, you know, Ron DeSantis runs the roost in the GOP. Just for the voters, this seems like a terrible idea, no?
Well, we had numerous polls done over the last year, including in the weeks of last year's legislative session when mm-hmm. 256 passed. Mm-hmm. The legislation is incredibly unpopular. Union support in Florida is well over 70%, according to many different polls. Unions for our teachers are even higher. And we even saw polling recently that showed that an overwhelming majority of people in Florida believe that teachers should have the right to strike.
Yeah.
Which right now is banned in our Constitution as part of the agreement that was made back in the day for Article 10, Section 1.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be very interesting how this plays out politically. But again, you know, when the bill was passed, there was no constituency group asking for it. There was no public sector employers asking for it. There were no public sector employees asking for it. It was 100% driven by billionaire out-of-state think tanks who the governor was currying favor with for his presidential run, and a legislature that was all too willing to turn, you know, their authority, their constituents over to his political ambitions.
Yeah. And how'd that work out for DeSantis, by the way? I think it didn't go well, even down
well,
in Florida.
It went about as well as it did for Scott Walker in Wisconsin, right?
There
I mean,
you go.
How long was Walker in the presidential run? I mean,
yep.
So I guess the last impression I'd like to leave with your listeners is right now, and this is not me just being a Pollyanna, right now, the numbers, you know, they are what they are and they look terrible. But we have we have dozens of elections that are pending with PERC. right? Once those elections happen, and we believe that they will be successful, the organizing is happening on the ground to make sure that that we are successful. Mm-hmm. Those numbers are going to change, and workers are going to get their unions back. They're going to get their contract, they're going to get their contract servicing back. Mm-hmm. And that's how it's going to have to go. And for those unions that are unable to organize in the state and regain prior local unions, we're working at the national labor movement level to figure out ways that other organizations can come in and work to represent those individuals. So the numbers are really bad right now. I think that this is just a snapshot. It's a particularly bad snapshot, but there is a lot of organizing happening here to turn that around as quickly as possible.
Well,
and the law does give us some opportunity to do it. It's just very difficult.
Well, it is difficult, but it's going to take the people. The people. We saw it in Wisconsin. We saw it in Michigan. Hopefully, we will see it in Florida, whether it takes a decade to dig out from or not, as it has in those other states. But it's going to have to be, I think, ultimately done at the ballot box, and voters are going to have to, put their vote where their mouth is and push back against these guys who say, Trump and DeSantis, they're for the forgotten working man, and they're against big government regulations, when they are doing exactly the opposite. Rich, I got to get out. Rich Templin, thank you so much. He is, of course, the legislative and political director of the Florida AFL-CIO. I hope you'll stay in touch with us as this moves forward. You can follow him on Twitter at R. Templin. You'll recognize it because he's got an avatar of Captain America. Well done, sir. Rich Templin.
We don't like bullies.
Really appreciate you joining us today, Rich. Hope to speak to you again in the future.
Thank you, sir, very much.
Thank you. All right, we got to get out, but I'll tell you what. I just want to say this. Come on, Florida. You are being hosed by Donald Trump, by Rich Ron DeSantis. Come on. You used to be a swing state, man. What happened?
Get your act together.
Thank you. Yes, please. All right. Thanks again to Rich Templin. Thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. That's made possible by those of you kind enough to hit that donate button or go to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter. I am the Brad Blog. I need a Captain America avatar. That's it. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.